Okay, so
you get the flip here?
Yeah. So which brings us to the point then. What is conscious mediumship under these conditions?
Okay, mediumship is traditionally seen as an activity of trance, and many people become mediums because they're hypnotized by it. It begins with the famous Mesmer. He mesmerized people.
Yes.
I know that Ralph Doobie, the first medium for cosmic awareness, he was hypnotized. He had cancer, and they were trying to do some therapy on him and hypnotize himself. He got hypnotized by a psychologist for therapeutic purposes, but then unwittingly cosmic awareness came out. So you can see that hypnotizing is associated with being a trance person, a medium. Conscious mediumship would be a concept that would show up in the 60s because we weren't being hypnotized or able to be tranced into a cultural bias. So Dave Worcester shows up at that point and says, hey, this is a case of conscious mediumship, but we can only be in a position of poise when we observe the suspended judgment we're forced to be in, and that could be called a kind of conscious mediumship because whatever you spoke, you're already aware of the effects of it because there's no environment that can respond to it. But that now, conscious mediumship is a fact for everyone because you are imposing your hypnosis. So conscious mediumship was a state of unhypnotizable. You could not be hypnotized, but you might be aware of certain levels that speech and earlier media could hypnotize people. So you do conscious mediumship. You do conscious trancing. And you might be – the direction of the trance is going both ways, inner and outer. But now the mediumship, conscious mediumship would be what you're trying to make the medium do. So when you make a YouTube, like Buzz Kosten, he makes a YouTube, he wants the YouTube to show that the imagery and the YouTube itself knows it's creating a certain effect. He wants to show the YouTube is conscious of what it's doing. So the new situation is, here's the breakthrough, Andrew. The new situation, we're trying to make the tiny little old media bodies conscious mediums.
Yeah, totally. So it's, what is it, the trope ekphrasis, is it?
Say that again?
I think the trope is it ekphrasis, where it's we show them as parodying themselves and making themselves
right.
aware of themselves.
Right. The put-on factor that you like to point out, McLuhan discovered in the 60s, the importance of put-on and how people's sensibility – see, there's where put-on comes in the mid-60s because – in the art world, they're intuiting that, hey, no matter what I do, it's a put-on because nobody can be hypnotized by it because they're subject to too many shifts to be hypnotized. You can't hypnotize people anymore. Okay, but they were hypnotized by that tactile fluidity. They were hypnotized by the fact that they were in a situation where they couldn't be hypnotized. They didn't know why they couldn't be hypnotized anymore. And there was much yearning to get re-hypnotized. A lot of the fundamentalisms in the world or in sciences and everywhere were attempts to jump back into the corporate skin and be part of a culture. You can see that much of the culture dynamic the last 30 years is people trying to find a place to be part of, a community to be part of, trying to fit back in so they can say, okay, now I'm hypnotized and enjoy this community that I accept their hypnotism. So conscious me not being able to do that, then you only could be a conscious medium. You could never be an unconscious medium, which would be a trans victim of the bias of a culture.
Yep.
You couldn't be a zombie anymore. Now, that seems to clarify that point, meaning of conscious medium in the 60s. Now, you're allowing your medium to put it on itself. You don't have to be bothered putting on. You're letting all these tiny little echoes of previous magical bodies, which is Wilfred Watson's term for different technological environments or technological cliches, their magic bodies. You try to see them. You try to make your conscious. You try to make your magic body appear to be a conscious medium. Now, this is something I've never said before, and we couldn't say in parts 1 and 2. This article has helped us come to this point. to the absurd statement that, hey, I'm just trying to make my YouTube be a conscious medium, okay? Leave me out of it. Yeah, that is incredible. If I go on Charlie Rose I get Buzz Coast and go on Charlie Rose to explain his YouTubes, and I tell Buzz, just keep telling them that you're trying to get your YouTubes to be a conscious medium. Now, that is beautiful, because that's assuming that the chip body's alive, and now it's a programmable body. It's now your child.
Yeah, that's... I'll have to digest that one for a while.
So multi-consciousness. Here's Wilfred Watson trying to get McLuhan to recognize multi-consciousness, which McLuhan, of course, understood. But I would tell Wilfred Watson, hey, multi-consciousness is now in the machines. I mean, I'm sure the way he asked many questions at the beginning of the article, that multi-consciousness is included in the technologies. I'm not sure. He doesn't say it. But let's go back to his questions. At the beginning of the article, he says, he thought of four topics. What is the nature of cliche, the nature of multi-consciousness? What's that scraping you're doing?
Scrolling with the mouse.
It's quite loud. The third one, nature of McLuhan's empiricism, and four, the relation of art to multi-consciousness. Then he said, these four topics led us to debate, in effect, the following alternatives. Whether cliche is false soul psychic energy, or whether it is to be regarded as an act of consciousness. Whether consciousness is better understood by relating it to psyche and dissociating. Now, this is the key point. Whether consciousness is better understood by relating it to psyche and dissociating it from its objects, or whether it should be considered to be coordinated with its instrumental expressions via the media and the technologies.
Yeah.
That's a key question. And whether it is better to understand meaning technologies as extensions of the human senses, or whether it is better to regard the meaning technologies as multiplications of the human senses. Whether the artist is a Captain Cook exploring a terra incognita, or whether he is a totem maker exploring the new tribal awareness. I don't think those questions ever came to an answer, a final decision, as far as McLuhan was dealing with it.
That's a pretty big question.
Hey, look what he says.
Yep.
Yeah. He follows it up and says, I usually took the left-hand side of these debates. What is the left hand? Is that, it could mean left hemisphere? And he took the literate view, the guy trying to define it?
I think, no.
What does he mean?
I think he means like left hand in the sense of reading left to right, and it's the left in the sense of first. So it would be the artist is a Captain Cook exploring the terra incognita would be Wilfred Watson's point.
Oh,
and McLuhan's point where the artist is totem maker exploring the new tribal awareness.
Right, that's the right-hand side. Oh, okay, that's a good... Okay, I didn't get that. So you find these are big questions, but to the degree McLuhan said he didn't have the answers, he had the questions, and there is no finish line, these are the questions that he had. Is consciousness connected to the object or isn't it?
Yes.
And so to be a satirist, he took the idea that consciousness was connected to the objects and their environments. He took the right-hand side as a put-on.
Yeah, it's that idea that but can consciousness be separated from its object?
If he was tactile, he would not only take both sides, the left hand and right hand side of these debates, he would do other positions too.
Yeah, absolutely. In a certain sense, the artistic process is mandatory. It's always ongoing, and then the artistic product or the technology, the artifact that comes out, is that which hypnotizes and then subsumes and subverts the original or the ongoing act of consciousness and understanding and making sense. And so, yeah, McLuhan's on both sides of that situation, and yeah, there is no finishing line insofar as they cannot be separated. It's only a new good art, which would restore some balance, bad art, which would enslave in a certain sense.
Right. So the in his very first article in the first issue of the Explorations magazine in December 1953, he has in there talking about the agenda of the magazine. He says, "We reserve the right for self-correction." Do you remember that sentence?
Yes.
We will discuss the He says we will have self-correction in our dialogue. So it's open-ended. The other thing is, let's look at the tetrad as a stage direction. He's showing the actor that he must take the extended position, then the obsolete position, then the retrieve position, and then the flipping into its opposite position. The tetrad is actually the four positions that McLuhan was taking in any public encounter.
Yes. Like he mimes
the
conscious act of making
sense. Yeah, it's a mime. Right, so if you've got television making everybody discarnate and super angels and no bodies, then you take the body and it must confound the TV cyclops by being a physical body, hopping all over the place, doing the tetradix dance, the tetradix, you know, two-step. And that was the only way the physical body could counter the environmental effects, the invisibility effects of television. And so the answer was the miming of the dilemma, or the miming of the effect of television, or the miming of what in any environment would be. This is very interesting.
Yeah, which almost brings us to the point of, can we talk about hope now? Is this an appropriate juncture?
Okay, yeah.
Okay, so...
No, that's important.
So in
you go.
Okay, so in terms of our pre-conversation that we were just having before we hit the record button, Bob and I were talking about hope and the fact that McLuhan was perceived as offering hope in this idea of, in response to, say, television, you'd adopt a counter-technology of print. At least temporarily, it would afford you some release. And there was a calculated intermediate jujitsu of... a chance for freedom or a chance of juggling your hypnosis so you had some release from the despair of it all. And, I guess that's what we're at the situation is now, is whether those same techniques even apply or can be applied in the same situation, or whether we're in a whole new landscape where actual McLuhan's hope is eclipsed.
Yeah, so... Definitely people thought, when they read Understanding Media, they were overwhelmed by the eccentric view of things, unaware of the put-on manipian satire part of McLuhan, but they just were impressed with the ideas the book made them think of. Many people thought it was a utopian vision, that there was this way to break through Big Brother, that electric media were creating autonomy and freedom and flow and flux and all kinds of these fantasies, many of them projected 19th century romantic fantasies, put on what the environment McLuhan was leading towards. And there were warnings in Understanding Media, but it seemed to have a utopian or hopeful aspect, and many people liked the early 60s mood of hopefulness. You know, many people lived through it, say there was a mood of optimism, which then was crashed by the late 60s. But McLuhan was seen as part of that hopeful mood and was talking technically about it. So McLuhan knew to include the services of the situation, not all despondent or not all paralyzed and just saying, well, we're discarded, there's no way out of it. I find in this talk by Eric, this recent one, he is laying out McLuhan's technical agenda of the discarded situation, but he only gives the impression of a warning. It tends toward, uh-oh, this is going to be pretty overwhelming. He does not have any way of talking about to implant the utopian inspirational facts that McLuhan planted in Understanding Media. Now,
yeah, well, you I, asking I'll, if I'll McLuhan, just add something on that. It's I think going right back to Chesterton, is he found in Chesterton straighten them out and give people something to be happy at. The use of the Apulian is a motivational genre to instill a sense of heroic fortitude. You know, and whether in later life is possibly to at least instill a sense of joy that despite being swallowed up, you can still enjoy being swallowed up by the magical beasts that are around us. There is definitely that agenda at work.
Yeah, and definitely the utopian feeling of the 60s disappeared by the 70s, into the 70s. And many people said McLuhan got pessimistic. No, people just saw the pessimistic aspect of what he was saying. Yeah. He was always in four positions. So he wasn't either optimistic or pessimistic. He always said he was apocalyptic. But the apocalypse was him dancing around four positions. And so what would be, then you say, what was McLuhan's technique of hope? What would it be today? Because you couldn't, you couldn't use the 60s technical utopianism in the 80s. It was over. It was very hard to get people to be inspired. Most of the inspirations were fundamentalisms that were rearview mirror movements that were reacting, not acting. They were reacting and operating, creating a hope out of the defensive position. So what would be, it's a really good question, what would, if you were going to present the technical miming of the world today, what would you use for utopian embeds or parts of this canvas? You got to have a bit of the good stuff in there that's coming. Well, I see myself doing that with Time Will Call Fusion, but I don't just talk about it. I claim I'm bringing it in because most people subject to the Android meme are on the sidelines. Feel like they're on the sidelines and let the Android mean just run the technical ship. So this passivity, this obsolescing of the chemical body and even the discarnate body by the Android meme leaves people in a pretty despondent situation. So the only way you could inject hope is to say, no, this technology won't do this for you. I'm going to take the new technology and impose it on you. That's the way you do it today. Which is what because people can't even listen. People don't believe anything anymore. McLuhan was operating when people still believed something. It was the last gasp of the humanist vision they projected on McLuhan.
Yeah.
Or the technotopian vision. That's long gone. And you're right to say McLuhan's technique wouldn't work today. You've got to come up. You have to say that, hey, I'm part of the elite and I'm going to give it to you. I am the Android meme and I'm going to give it to you. You never thought we'd do this for you. That's my answer to how to inject hope today. Now, but the Android meme itself is giving people hope. If the environment gave people hope because with Web 2.0, it shrunk everything and everybody started to feel bigger than the media.
Yeah, and there's plenty of utopias around the retrieved democratic potential of that, and which is rapidly giving way to discourse that it's an illusory utopia, and that the disservices of Web 2.0 are already in full view.
Right, that's why we're at that now, since the crash of Wall Street and all that, the disservices of the Web 2.0 empowering of the day trader. Day trader can be a metaphor for all kinds of activities. It's your autonomy as you edit and program the old magical bodies that has collapsed. And so the next phase is to be given something, and that would empower you, and that would be cold fusion, what I present. And it would be imposed on you, whether you like it or not. We're going to bring you free energy. And we're going to make you immortal with our daily bread and living water.
So McLuhan offers an active individualism as a sense of hope, and Bob brings a totalitarian don't do nothing, just be passive.
Big brother.
Stay at home, read a book, and I'll bring big cold fusion.
Wait for Bob. we're coming. We're big sister. We're big. What are we? Big. No, we're tiny, friendly little sister. He's no longer big brother, because it's little, tiny, friendly sister, little sister.
Yeah.
Little sister, it's like somebody there's some kid 6 years old and can play every musical composition in classical music ever done. You know, you get these little dwarf geniuses, midget geniuses. I even say in my manifesto, Up the Orphiandi, that Carol and I are the tallest midgets in the world, so, and I emphasize the dwarf aspect and Rumpelstiltskin, so it fits what I said, but McLuhan, he prefigured the appropriate response in the 60s, and Watson realizes that, and he begins the article by saying, look, I believe McLuhan owned the 60s. He was on to the postmodern, the cyborg, all these issues that dwindled, that after images had come later. He was it. He had it. And then he has his refinement of what McLuhan meant. And that's where he's arguing a bit. But I think, I could even say that McLuhan, he had reached the point of now. He did say, look, just let me run the global thermostat and I'll build a program of sensory dynamics globally. He actually was starting to act out the imposing of the utopia. You know what I mean? Whereas Watson is still arguing about, well, what do I do to make a better world or something? Or I better know what is, and that technologies are a unit of expansion, a unit of awareness. He had not put on the Dobbstown solution. You know, he had not gone to the little friendly sister level that McLuhan was starting to intuit, right?
Yeah, okay. So,
I mean,
so when you're saying impose, now that brings up an interesting thing. Like, if we're talking about bodies as being larger than programmable media environments, then it this wakes up the illusory dimension, the fact that in a certain sense these big bodies still exist in the cloud. You know, they're not... they don't have a ground to stand on. So in a sense, even these giant bodies are figures without ground.
Yeah, there's no technical environment that ever gets annihilated. It gets absorbed, gets displaced and moved into another kind of position, another kind of attitude that's acceptable under the new mood. Big Brother is seen, that's the popularity of conspiracy websites. Big Brother is seen lurking in here and there to jump on the Web 2.0 and hijack it back again. And you have the some people thinking that 9/11 led to the new fascism of the Patriot Bill. Now you have, it's projected on Obama as a guy who's a socialist, a global socialist, communist, who's taking government, is having government apparently take over big business. That lurking, the revenge of the old Big Brother analog media thing is always lurking there. It's like the specter of communism. There's a specter of the monster magnet of analogical media when they were bigger than human bodies. That's lurking
the cloud.
There.
The cloud.
Yeah, the cloud. And you know what? In my tiny note chart, I have the cloud as the metaphor in the Croker quadrant, and Croker was always saying that. Basically, he didn't emphasize the services of the Web 2.0 or even Web 1.0. He was saying, watch out, there's a Leviathan lurking in there, lurking inside there, seducing you, duping you. The big capitalist monster is still in there. You know what I mean? That's actually what he was trying to point out.
Yeah, no, I fully agree, but I think that's where we drop off the edge of Croker and we get into the new situation,
which Watson helps us to bypass Croker and get into the Dobbsian five bodies. That's what's incredible. I mean, I sometimes when I read this article first, 7 years ago, I forgotten most of it till I read it today. When I read it 7 years ago, I thought, what do I think that Watson was picking up on an important point, which is the shrinking of the magic body and the wild body the ground of the wild body coming forward. And I saw that that's what I'd been doing. I thought it was interesting that he got to that point. And like I've said before, when you study McLuhan, there are stages of understanding, almost like a formula, that you will go through and you will get these later questions and you will end up being in the Watson position of coming up with something that McLuhan wasn't referring to. And that's the magic body and the wild body. The irony is he gets the wild body from Lewis, and Lewis was the hidden ground of McLuhan's work. So Watson had to go to the original guy, Lewis, to find the concept of the magic body so he could make a position contrary to McLuhan.
Yes, yes.
But McLuhan got it from Lewis too. So that makes Lewis pretty important, that if you get both aspects out of Lewis. So what I here's what I was saying that I got 7 years ago. Wow, if you think about McLuhan long enough, you will have to come to the five-bodied or magic body point. You will get to that.
Yeah, no, it's logical. It's and that's, I guess, what I enjoy in this is this article is it does it just it gives you a different language to arrive at that same conclusion. And then it's how do you deal with it? Then he's talking about the multiplicity of magical bodies, and so to have five bodies has to give way to six bodies, to seven bodies, to 22 bodies. To it opens up to actually a massive science bomb.
Yeah, so multi-consciousness, which sounds like the person having multi-consciousness, when the croaker phase, the next phase in the digital media is that the android meme has multi-consciousness. And what would be mediumship within inside that? Because mediumship implies something's being expressed, a message is being given. There's no messages in the Android Meme Post Information Society situation. You know, there's no messages to be received by other humans. They can't get past the border patrol, the passport control of the Android Meme. It's going to nullify any message. So conscious mediumship would be putting on a state of telling. You're going to tell something. I'm going to tell you something. Back in the old days, before the Android Meme, you could tell people something. But when you can't, you put on the act of telling. So conscious mediumship could also mean mediumship as a put-on.
Yep.
Conscious mediumship does have, and then the Android Meme does that. I mean, the Android Meme is a total put-on, a complete put-on squared, making you think. It puts you on so much, it makes you think you're doing the putting on of the magic bodies. And I say that McLuhan had all that in his understanding, and Watson just kind of came up with some good new dialectic, magic body versus wild body, to help explain the technical unconscious, which McLuhan meant. I mean, the statement about technical unconscious is in Counterblast. But, okay, you speak.
Yep, okay, so in McLuhan as well, there's he makes a distinction between a conscience and a conscience without consciousness and a seiousness. I can't even say it. Conscious, it's like a consciousness without the con. Yeah, there you go. And he differentiates
consciousness without what?
Without
the con. Without what?
The con.
Yeah. Yes. But have you noticed that he would play with conscience?
Yeah.
Consciousness. He like sometimes where you'd see where the word conscious should be, he puts in conscience.
Yeah.
Now that would be a good pun, because I think Eric gets into that in a bit of his speech. No, he doesn't, but I thought of it as he was talking. To have a conscience is the literary effect. So to consciousness is only possible under literate conditions. You can't have consciousness in the electric environment. At best, you have multi-consciousness or multi-consciences or situational ethics.
Yes.
And the best way to put order to that is to present the tetrad as your dance moves. That mimes the situation.
Yeah, absolutely. And so today, like with there's the wild body. Is the wild body have a that situation? The conch is it? I can't even pronounce the word.
Does it have a consciousness
without the con? Because if it's existing in an individual, this wild caveman state.
That's a good point. Doesn't he say shishness at some point?
Yeah, yeah.
He drops the con and
says, yeah, yeah. That's what I'm trying to say. It's like I've never actually heard that word actually said, so I can't.
Well, I did it. I yeah. said it first person to say shishness. Yeah. The con. There's only con in visual space and in capitalism and in industrial man. There's no con in tribalism. There's just put on, or don't even want to say put on because that's irony. I don't know how ironic tribal people are, how flexibility they are in their irony. I mean, tragic and comedy comes in with literacy. So the condition before that is either hyper cynicism or hyper put on or manipianism everywhere. Anyways, the con would be the literate artifact. Shishness or shints, not shunts, conscience. That's the literary product. Shishness is the condition of tribal man.
Yeah, like flowing of percept, a total just without integration.
Yeah, you're integrated into the tribes, so you're a zombie. But there's lots of services to being a zombie, a lot more dancing, a lot more music. But today, and McLuhan saw this, we weren't mass man was not tribal. He wasn't literate. He wasn't post literate. He was a tactile relationship.
Yep.
And that's what he meant by multi-consciousness. So here's Watson talking about multi-consciousness. McLuhan had turned multi-consciousness into an art form disguised as the tetrad.
That's a nice statement.
Yeah. I just find it interesting how to be in McLuhan's position and to know that no one really could catch up to him. And a smart man like Watson makes a valiant effort, even to the point that he thinks that he's making a distinction that McLuhan missed. It only takes a fine scholar like myself to point out that Watson did not succeed in finding something McLuhan did not know. Mm. Maybe you've made a few contributions to that endeavor too, Andrew.
That's
right?
Don't
know. You got a PhD. You actually got a PhD out of that position. That's pretty good. I didn't get any PhD out of it. All I got was worldly fame. I became a conscious medium and all I did was become famous, whereas the real goal was to get a PhD.
No goal, Bob. It's just preserving slack.
Yeah. Who is? The PhD or me?
You have to work way too hard.
That's right. You are now in a very slackable position. You even have time to talk to me now.
Yeah, it's
and
great.
And record it. Yeah, the PhD works wonders.
And on that note, I think with a view to preserving some usefulness, let's call it a quit there. I think we've probably reached about the hour and something mark. And so if we can pause there and resume at a later date.
Yeah, it ends on a hopeful note. You know, the PhD once was the bomb, BALM, of optimistic living.
Yep, and then we'll...
But, I just want to say this. I want to say this before we end. Are we still recording?
Yeah, we're still recording.
Yeah. I don't know if I feel this every week, but we still haven't... I don't know if we're communicating. Did you get some insights tonight?
Yeah, I did. I did. Most of my insights come when I step back and replay. I find it difficult being in a dialogue where I'm not completely comfortable with where I'm going with it. Like, you've had the benefit of 30 or 40 years with this material, and some of these things are still new to me. And so a lot of my insights will come when I step back and I detach and listen to my own fumbling and what you have to say. And then hopefully it'll spiral off into a next session.
Right. So you do re-listen to these and get a lot out of them and re-listening.
Yeah, yeah. I find in the act of talking, I get sucked into the act of talking and being, present in the act of talking and trying to be conscious of maintaining some sense of time in relation to this recorded output. I suspect Scott and your other dialogue partners will express a similar state of mind.
Yeah, I'm not trying to dominate. Like I did, I get the more verbal time in this segment. If you didn't mind, I'd let you go on in the second hour and dominate. But you may not have stuff immediately handy to say. Now, I've got a lot to say, maybe because I've been thinking about it for so long. So I could go on, but I don't want to be dominating. This is not learning from Bob. I don't want that to be, you know what I mean? I want you're capable of contributing to this. So I would like more input from you, but you feel it's working out okay. I mean, I'm not saying you haven't been putting input into it, but is it okay with you that you're not saying as much as me?
No, I'm very comfortable with it. I mean, I'll state it plainly that part of my agenda, I guess, is to bring out the best, or to at least attempt to bring out what I found to be the best of Bob. And I'm comfortable with my state as sort of a partial interviewer. I know you've suggested that dialogue is more preferable, but in time, Bob, definitely we'll get there. But there's a lot of stuff that you have not expressed elsewhere that I'm hoping will spill out here.
Well, I think we have done that. I've said things I never had a chance to talk about conscious mediumship before, and I'm getting new insights. I've never thought of the tetrad as a dance, you know, by a person on stage before, or the way to show the four positions, the four characters. I mean, McLuhan was the director, and then he had himself do the four positions and the drama among them to show what was happening in the global theater. It's actually pretty astounding.
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot will come out of that. At the talk that I was at in Melbourne, there was a woman there from the Eastern Orthodox Church, for example, and she was discussing how essentially the tactility of the Eastern Orthodox extends from a circular dance, like a collective circular dance where people hold hands. And so that's like the base, how would you call it, ritual gesture from which an Eastern mindset emerges. And she was saying how she finds it very difficult to interface with a Western dance, and how, for example, we face each other. And so in a sense, McLuhan brings in the tetrad as a kind of dance that is both circular and collective, and individual and more vertical. And so he's presenting what do you call it, the anamorphic Baroque spiral, or Möbius strip of multi-dimensional dancing. Okay, so the tape's just resuming. We've just been dropped a couple of times, so this will be a little bit disjointed. I was heading off into a rant about the relationship between Eastern and Western dancing. I should probably save that for another day.
Okay, but you were talking about the collective and the private or something?
No, it was about talking about the tetrad as a kind of dance that is both horizontal and vertical, and like has a Möbius quality to it.
Right, and the so you were pointing out how this woman at the Melbourne conference was expressing her problems with Western dance. And why was she talking about McLuhan?
Not at all. She was essentially talking about the Eastern Orthodox theology, and she was rooting the habitus of Eastern Orthodoxy in a particular dance, like, you know, the ring dance, where a lot of people hold hands and they dance in a circle. As suggestive of that kind of tactile interplay that, like our friend Pseudo Dionysius exhibits, you know, between the cataphatic and the vide negative theologies, and a sort of Greek Orthodox kind of tactility, if you will, as opposed to a Western kind of a tactility, and I'm suggesting that the tetrad is kind of a dance which sits in a tactile fashion between these two tactilities.
Yeah, yeah, that's true. You have to include both when you're talking tactility. Okay, so the question, how do you tell the dancer from the dance? The meaning of that question, the dilemma it poses, is always there, but Watson is trying to update that question with new terms, new envelopes, new bodies. So, and then Watson's trying that, and you're coming up with the example of this woman at the conference who gave an example that allowed you to say, yeah, how can you tell one tactility from the other tactility? You know, it's the, how can you tell the dance from the dancer? That's a subject-object position. That's not, how can you tell one environment from another is the question now.
Yeah.
How
yeah.
can you tell one medium from another medium within Android meme conditions? That's why, you know, it's not useful to use the word radio, telephone, and movie in terms of the today's situation.
Yeah, no,
so it's now, how do you tell one? Yeah, and how do you tell one magical body from the other with the purpose of activating your wild body? Because the wild body, the fact it's wild because you don't know what it is. It's the mystery that everything comes out of. Not the mystery, not some abstract mystery, the mystery of experience. Absolutely. The mystery of, the dance between thought and words. That is, what is it? I know it like a snake swimming in water, the dance of thought among words. Now it's thought among magic bodies. The dance of thought among magic bodies. Because the magic body digital phase is life at the speed of thought. The old analog phase was the speed of light. And, you know, the old analog physicists, they'll say that light goes faster than thought. But we're not conditioned by that literate model anymore. So we can say, yes, no, thought's faster than light.
So have you come to a conclusion on that one? How do we determine the difference between magical bodies? How do we make distinctions and separations?
Beg your pardon?
Have you, in your scheme, Bob, how do you actually tell the difference between these magical bodies? How do you actually talk about them sensibly? So you talk about echoes and after images of forms. Is there another way?
I can talk about them with the finest aesthetic distinction and enunciation of qualitative differences, but that's for those people who live in the past.
Yep.
The present is the imposition of cold fusion on you and everybody who's listening. I'm not talking anymore. I'm not asking questions or presenting questions anymore. I'm like Kinner, a somnambulist walking through post history. That's a good one. I'm a conscious medium walking through like a somnambulist through post history. That's a good one. I'm dancing through post-history.
Now I can hear Mark Stelman now. He's saying, the megalomania, it's just got bigger,
yeah,
Bob.
Yeah. The demon has taken over Bob again. The demon trance. The demon conscious medium. The demonic conscious medium. Conscious demonism. Yeah, this is good. I like that. You know, Hitler said, I'm a mere somnambulist walking through history. Well, I like this. I'm a conscious medium dancing through post-history, whether you like it or not, and with or without you.
See, at this point, yeah, we've got to stop it there. Like, what?
Okay, that's a great ending. I agree.
I'll try and denounce you or praise you on some grounds in our next session if you consent to do it.
Oh, no, we're going to go on. We're just getting started. You ain't heard nothing yet.
Nice. Okay, thank you, Bob. And with a bit of luck, we'll resume in about a week's time. So I'll push stop now, and I'll get this tape up to 5 Volleyed as soon as possible.